This is HPR episode 1871 entitled HPR Community News for September 2015 and is part of the series HPR Community News. It is hosted by HPR volunteers and is about 92 minutes long. The summary is HPR Community News for September 2015.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Okay, blather is off, and that will free up some... I don't know how much resources blather uses in terms of the things like... What's that? Pulse? Pulse audio? I know it's constantly listening, so it must do something. Anyway, I don't want my computer doing wacky things, because what happens is I've always got blather going, and as long as I'm by myself, everything's good, but if somebody walks into my office and starts talking to me, my computer sometimes will just start doing crazy things.
Yeah. That sounds great. I like that.
It's funny. Like, the first thing I have to do when somebody comes in to see me is hold up my index finger saying, hang on one sec. So I stop blather from going, and then we can have our conversation without any important files being deleted or messed up or whatever. Who knows what Blather is going to do? Because it thinks you're talking to it all the time. It doesn't know there's somebody else in the room.
No. It makes perfect sense. That's great. Right. Okay. Shall we head off then?
Yep.
One thing just to point out: we normally go through the shows. You know how this is done, but the bit where we come to the mail, reviewing the mail messages. What we normally do is I've got lots of links into Gmail where we have copies of our messages, but the thing seems to be broken today. I don't think it's up. I'm having difficulty getting to it. So what I might do is, I found that we have a full record of everything on the mailman list. The archive system used not to work, but now it is working. So I'm going to point to that. I don't know if you're bothered particularly whether you're going to track that yourself, but just to warn you.
I did see at the show notes here a list of the mailing list topics. I can click through to that. If it seems like we're going to be discussing something for a little while, I'll go ahead and click through.
You might find that they don't get you anywhere. That's the problem.
Those
links seem to be, the thing at the other end seems to be a bit flaky today.
Well, it opened up a new tab, and looks like it's taking a moment here. Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe it's not going to do anything.
We'll see how we go anyway. No problem.
Yep, no worries.
Okay, right. Here we go then. Hello, everybody. This is the HPR Community News Show for September 2015. And my name is Dave Morris, and I have with me tonight John Culp. Hi, John.
Hey, everybody.
So Ken's not available tonight, so I think I'm in the hot seat. I hope I can remember how to do this. And we're going to start off with probably me messing up my screen because I've got the wrong push-to-talk button. I made control my push to talk, and then I try and scroll, and of course the screen shrinks, and I keep doing this. I really got to learn. Anyway, new hosts. We have one new host this past month, and that is Geddes. Geddes, I think his name is.
I'm not sure how that would be pronounced.
I think it might be a Welsh name, but I hope he doesn't come back and tell me off for saying that. But it's a name you do come across occasionally in an English context, but it may be a handle. I don't know.
I don't know either. I think I remember him saying it in his episode, but I've forgotten now how it was pronounced.
Anyway, let's launch straight into the last month's shows. And the first one, that was me just clicking to it. Hopefully I'll be able to take all the delays out. Now I'm talking about them. Of course, we can't take the delays out. But the first one was Sigflop. Welcome return of Sigflop, who did a show entitled Client Side CW2TF is Wrong with You. that was a talk about using a rather wonderful bit of software called Mscripten, which is capable of converting C and C++ into JavaScript, which is something I've never considered ever wanting to do. What do you think of that, John?
Well, I don't know. I got to confess, most of her episodes leave me a little bit confused, but I think what this was all about was some kind of thing that allows you to run C code like on the fly in a browser. Is that am I getting that right?
That was my understanding. Yeah, it's pretty astonishing when you consider that you can, first of all, that JavaScript can actually do that, emulate a piece of C, and quite fast from what she said. There's a thing that's actually turning this stuff in, it's turning C or C++ into this. That's pretty astonishing.
That is pretty cool. I don't really know what application I personally would have for it, but I think it's a pretty cool sounding thing. I wonder if there are any security risks to doing something like that.
Yeah, I have no idea. you think you could do some pretty evil things in C and presumably C++. So quite what how that would operate in JavaScript, I have no idea. But it's pretty cool. What we'll do as we go through the shows, we'll just if there's comments, we'll just deal with them as we pass through. Yeah.
So yeah, that sounds fine.
There was a comment on this show from Gabriel Evenfire, who says, I always look forward to your shows because I know there'll be something really unusual, so some really unusual technical material in them. This one's no exception. I've never heard of Inscripten before, but I'm going to have a look at into this. It reminds me of a project a while back to compile C code using GCC to MIPS assembly that would run on a MIPS interpreter in Java.
Holy cow.
Wow. Someone built it as a way to compile C programs that would never buffer overflow. Not exactly accurate, but the buffer overflows would never corrupt the interpreter's stack. So yeah, people have been writing some pretty bizarre things, seems, over the years.
Yeah, and these are things that a real programmer understands better than I do. I understand a little bit about Bash and Python, and that's about the extent of it. But
I've been a sort of what do you call them? A systems manager. They don't call
sysadmin.
Sysadmin. Yeah. My job title was systems manager. That's why I can never remember it. That was all about, you know, this thing stopped working, go and run about and try and make it work. It wasn't really doing anything as clever as this. It was just a machine jockey sort of thing, you know.
About uptime.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. So let's move on to the next one.
Should we take turns doing these things?
If you want to, yeah.
Okay, so the next one, episode 1848, this was Introduction to W3M, a Command Line Web Browser by Frank Bell, who has done a number of interesting episodes.
Yeah, this sounded pretty good, actually. I didn't think I had an application for a thing like this, but having heard what he was talking about, I sort of started to change my mind. What did you think?
I've used it a little bit before, and it's what I've used W3M for in the past is testing for my HTML code, sites that I'm building. If I want to test their accessibility in terms of making sure that all the images have alternate text and that you can navigate easily around using things like skip to main and, you know, stuff like that. It really is a very good text browser. I got to admit, I normally use Elinks instead of W3M, but I have used W3M in the past. It's handy.
Yeah, it's good to know that these things exist. I was listening to TuxJam, I think it was, where they were talking about a very lightweight GUI browser called Surf. When I'm using that where I need to to do really lightweight stuff at the moment. But I can see W3M and things of that sort could come in a similar place.
I've never heard of that. Oh, that you said it's Surf?
Surf, yes, yeah.
Okay, I should try that.
You should check that out. It's part of the, what's it called, Suckless Project? yeah, I think so. There was, if you listen to Floss Weekly on the Twit Network, they just interviewed the Suckless guys in that one. And they were
That's
talking
funny.
About,
That's what a great project name, isn't name. It?
That's fantastic. I like it.
It really is wonderful. Yeah, I might actually check out that the Surf browser. I'm looking for a browser to use with Zimbra, which is our mail and calendar application at the university. It's a collaboration suite, I guess they call it.
Yeah.
And right now it works best on Firefox. I'd been using Firefox almost exclusively for a long time just because of a certain accessibility feature, the quick search feature where you can start typing with either a forward slash or a single quote and it will start searching the text on the page and allow you to put focus on it quickly. I use this all the time with Blather. But I discovered a plugin for Chromium that implements the same functionality, and so I've switched over to Chromium because it's so much faster. However, Zimbra doesn't work right on Chromium. There's something about it. And so I'm keeping Firefox open just for that one web application. And if I could make, if Surf were to work with Zimbra correctly, I would probably rather do that because it would use less system resources.
You should check it out. It's a strange beastie. It's just a simple window that doesn't have any buttons or anything.
So that would be all right.
It's driven by keyboards, a keyboard input. I haven't really got to grips with it totally yet, but it seems to have some potential.
That would be perfect for the Zimbra web app because the Zimbra web client has all its own buttons inside the window there, and it's got a very robust set of keystrokes to navigate around to the calendar and to create new appointments and new emails and all that. So I don't need it to be very robust. I just need it to display correctly.
Yeah, well, what I've tended to do is I've got two monitors now. I acquired another one recently, and I have one with Vim in it, and the other one I fire up Surf into it. So if I'm editing Markdown, then I can generate my HTML and view it in the other window through Surf and fire it up out of Vim. That was the anyway, we're getting off the point here a bit, but
there'll be time to talk about Markdown later.
I'm sure there will. Yes. Okay, there was one comment to this one from Tom Len. Do you want to do that one, John?
Oops. Have I been talking all this time without my button pressed here?
I think you've been in mute.
Man, that is funny. I read that whole comment without my button pressed.
Oops.
I forgot that it's push to talk.
It's so easily done.
Let me start over again here.
Okay.
The title of the comment is automatize login from command line. I don't know if that automatize is really a word or not, but
well,
I kind of like
it. I would say automate, but then I'm British, so there you go.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, he says, I just discovered this tool, W3M, and I was wondering if it could be possible to access a page that requires a login and password. I need it to be done automatically from the command line. I.e., I wouldn't be pressing any keys. It's a headless server. Do you know if that's possible? I would need to grab some text, but once logged in, the URL remains the same. Thanks in advance. And there is no response to this. I don't really know the answer to this question using W3M, but can't you use something like curl to enter a password and username?
Yeah, I think I would be doing something like that. I wasn't quite clear. What he needed to do, log into a web browser automatically. Why would you do that?
I don't really know. I would need some kind of demonstration or more detailed description of exactly what he's trying to accomplish here. But
there's probably a way, but as you say, something like curl might be the answer.
Yeah, you can do all kinds of stuff with curl. And so it seems like that would be the tool I would use. I wouldn't, if it's headless and you're not going to be actually reading it with your own eyeballs, I don't think you would want to use W3M necessarily, unless it's got some kind of detached. I don't know if that's the right word, but where you can just send a command and it'll grab some text, like elinks, for example. I use the elinks dump option quite often to grab the contents of a web page and then scrape it for just the part I want. And that will use the eLinks program, but without ever actually opening up the web page in a way where you can look at it.
Yeah, I'm sure there's all sorts of ways that you can do that. As you say, we'd need to know a little bit more about what he was trying to do, I suspect.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, let's move on. 1849 was the Linux Lugcast. Sorry, you there, John?
Did you step on my toes there? Is it my turn? Or is No, you did the last...
No, wait. You read the last show.
I think it's a measure of how slowly we're going that I... I forgot.
Okay, I'll do this one. Linux Lugcast episode 4 outtakes. So this is where Kevin Wisher posts some of the stuff that they don't publish on the Lugcast feed. So yeah, it's good. Only 9 minutes this time. We've had more significant chunks in the past. So come on, Kevin, we need more. We need more.
Yeah, I can't even. I can't really remember whether I listened to this one or not. I normally listen every day, but I don't remember if I heard this one or not.
I did, because I usually make notes on these things, and so I keep a wiki to keep that sort of stuff. And I just said to myself, very nice, but could have done with a bit more. So.
All right, so then episode 1850 is Ahuka doing SSH introduction. I'm not sure what the 18, is that a series number?
I think it is. I think this is part of privacy and security. I think that's the 18th of that series. That's the way I read it anyway.
That probably is correct. So the series Privacy and Security, episode 18, this is SSH introduction. And I love these. I mean, I've used SSH quite a lot, but it's just like with any show Ahuka does, he always points out something that I haven't heard of before.
Yeah, I thought it was a great introduction to the subject and a bit of history and everything. It was I'd forgotten quite how SSH had come to be. It was quite nice to have the reference back and go and check that out, actually, just to remind myself.
Yeah, I read a book. I wonder what... It seems like I might have sent that book to NY Bill. For a while there, we were reading books and then sending them along to other people in our little community. And then whoever read it next would send it to the next person and so forth. And I think one of the books I sent along was one about the history of public key encryption. And I don't remember the title of it now, but it talked about a lot of these kinds of things.
Yeah, it's an interesting subject. I had not quite remembered that this had started up as a sort of fairly open product. The Tatu Ylönen, I assume you pronounce his name.
I don't know.
In Helsinki. And then it sort of got turned into a commercial thing, become proprietary, and then in the OpenBSD guys had taken it away and done OpenSSH based on it, forked it effectively, I think. I had forgotten that, and it was good to be reminded of that, because it's good to know the history of these things, as I say.
Yeah. And I think there's going to be one more in this SSH series that we'll get to today. However, there are some comments here. And comment number one from OXF10E, Oxfordy. I don't.
Yeah, I always have trouble with that one.
He says the title of the comment is Portable Version of OpenSSH. Actually, the portable version of OpenSSH is needed on every platform other than OpenBSD, not just Unixoid ones. Winky face.
Right. Okay. Thank you. And Gabriel Evenfire said, this could be a very fruitful series. SSH is one of those Swiss Army knives that most people just use for the blade. I'm looking forward to seeing where this is going. There's a lot of potential uses to cover. Klaatu already added an episode talking about SSH config, which we're going to get to soon. And there are lots of useful shortcuts one can include from that alone. So I hope that more people, including you, Ahuka, keep this going.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, what also might be interesting is for those of us who are not going to talk so much about how OpenSSH works necessarily is just to run down the ways we use it.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah. I have a number of ways that I use it that are not necessarily the same as other people.
Yeah, I know there's a lot to it. There's a lot to it. I used to at work use it quite a lot, and there's a minus capital X option which lets you reflect back X sessions through it to your local workstation. So it's quite useful to be able to go to sort of headless servers or remote servers and get X sessions back. A bit slow, but you know, that's there's tons like that, loads and loads.
There's one more comment, and that's from the host, Kevin O'Brien. He says, "Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed this introductory episode. I've recorded and uploaded several more, and I'm not done. Is that a warning?" And Klaatu has also sent in an SSH show, so there is plenty to go around.
Very good. Okay, so the next one was the community news, so I don't think we want to reflect on that one, otherwise we go into one of those infinite circles, don't we?
Yeah. So I forget, did I do the last one or did you? Dave, are you
there?
Yeah,
sorry. Yeah, I'm biting my control, taking my finger off the control key when I want to do something on the screen and then forgetting to put it back on when I want to speak. Hold on a second.
I got you. So I can't remember whose turn it is here.
No, I can't remember either.
How about I go on the next one?
Do you want to go on the next one? Because it's my show, and that makes...
Yeah. So episode 1852, Dave Morris, Operation Wallacea. Wallacea? I don't know.
I had difficulty knowing how to pronounce this, and I'm told that the organization in themselves pronounce it Wallacea.
That sounds fine. That's good enough for me. This was a terrific episode. I really liked hearing about what your daughter was doing over there. And I went to their website and looked and saw that they've got projects going all around the world.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff. It's a great, great thing to do as a youngster, you know, to get involved in something like this. And it's great on your CV too, which is what a lot of people are, you know, doing it for the experience and for you know, being able to say, look, I want to do biology and here's how much I want to do it. I've actually done this during my vacation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, really, really terrific. So is she back in school this semester now?
Yes, she's getting heavily into her biology degree right now. She's doing
Sounds
a degree
good.
In animal behavior or behavioral studies or something of that nature. Can't remember the title, but yeah.
Sounds like something I would not understand.
Well, she's leaving me standing, I can tell you.
Shoot, my son is only 14, and he's already talking about scientific things that I don't remember ever learning in my life.
No, it's scary when they start to run past you in a way. It's a frightening thing.
It's good, though.
It's the way it should be.
So were there comments on this one?
Nothing on this one, no.
How could that be? We're commenting on it now, I guess.
Yeah, that's what this show is all about.
Okay, episode 1853, then?
Yeah, shall I? I'll just read this one. And this is Alpha 32, and his show is entitled I Heart Vista. I assume you pronounce it that way. So what's this? Somebody's commenting on Vista and on this channel. How I got into Linux it is, really. So
I believe what he's saying is he loves Vista because it helped him get into Linux because it was so bad. Is that what
that's exactly what I understood. Yes. It's right. I thought
kind
that
of
was
a backhanded compliment.
That was it's a good hook, that was. Everybody, what? How, what? Oh, right. Okay, gotcha. It was good.
It's
it was
funny.
Good. So, yeah, there was a comment which made that point as well. Aaron B483 says, great name for a podcast. I'm sure because of the name of your podcast, you probably got a lot of interest. So,
yeah.
A good one. Yeah, it was an interesting show, too. Some personal anecdotes about... learning the way around Windows things and finding that Linux is better, which is always good to hear.
Yeah. Speaking of moving from Windows to Linux, the next episode, 1854, is me talking about how we finally got Linux installed on my son's Asus TP500L, which came with Windows 8 installed. And here I talk about how I finally decided to try to get into the secure boot protected BIOS and disable that and allow installation of Ubuntu on there.
Yeah, it was a good story. It's this UEFI business is a worrying thing because you never know when it's going to lock you out totally from doing what you want to do. So good to hear that you managed to crack that one.
Yeah, it actually wasn't as hard as I feared it was going to be. I mean, like I said in the podcast, I knew when I bought this laptop for him that it had this feature, I guess, this negative feature of secure boot. But he just needed a new laptop, and he actually didn't mind Windows 8 that much once he got used to it. And then he installed Windows 10, which people kept saying have all these security and privacy issues. And so we thought, well, maybe it's time. And I'll say this, we did this maybe a month or 6 weeks ago, and he has not a single time booted back into Windows since then.
That says a lot, that does. Yes, that's fascinating. My daughter's also got a Windows 8 machine, and she is pretty much content with it because same reason that, you know, needs it for things related to study. She hasn't yet reached the point where she's gone to Windows 10 and has hated it. So she's moderately content at the moment. So hope yeah. That continues, you know.
Well, my son, there are certain things he likes about Windows 8, just because, like, there's so many things that will run on it that won't run on Linux, gaming kinds of things, and
sure.
But the kinds of compatibility issues that I was talking about, where he was worried about not being able to work with his classmates at school on projects, that issue is going away a little bit because it seems like more and more they are all using Google Drive and those online free services, you know, free as in beer anyway, services, and so he doesn't even necessarily need to use this Office product.
Yeah, well, that's good.
So yeah. He'll probably just stick with the one thing that's come up repeatedly since installing Ubuntu on there is that every time he gets a kernel update, we have to recompile the driver for his Wi-Fi, and that's always kind of a startling at first because he'll run the updates and then he'll say, "Dad, my Wi-Fi's not working." I remember, oh yeah, we gotta do something. So I finally wrote a script that he can run that will recompile the Wi-Fi driver and then install it in the right place, and it's all good after that.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good, but it's a pain that it has to be that way. But there you go. Yeah, yeah. At least he's got something that's
you're breaking up a little bit there, Dave.
Oh, right. At least he's got something that works well, though. That's the main thing. You there, John?
Your audio is breaking up a little bit.
Yours is breaking up for me, actually.
I'm not sure. I wonder if it's because my kids are watching videos or something. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, John. Yep.
Okay.
Okay. We good?
Well, I guess you're next.
1855 is Ahuka's number 61 in the series on LibreOffice. LibreOffice Impress slide layouts and auto layout text boxes. So this is more on the ins and outs of Impress and generating slides and so forth. I always go off and look at Ahuka's his own website for the details of this, and it's always really, really good very easy to follow and stuff. I find this one very useful. I don't actually need it anymore, but I have used this in the past, and it's good to have this sort of overview. I'm sure anybody who needs to generate slides will enjoy it a lot.
Okay, so you had just finished introducing the episode 1855 on LibreOffice Impress, and I missed nearly your whole thing. So, and I don't see any comments on it.
Yeah, so I guess we could just go on, because I'm hoping that if we work with the recordings at this end, then we're good. We should be good. Unless you wanted to discuss it in any degree.
Yeah, I mean, only to say what I always have. I should have this little disclaimer or canned response to all of his episodes about LibreOffice, which is they're awesome.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. I have no immediate need for them at the moment, but it's really good to be able to look under the hood a bit and see how it all works, just in case, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I use LibreOffice Impress. During school semesters, I use it almost every day. That's what I use to show slides in my classes and stuff like that. But a lot of the stuff he's talking about here, I have not really explored before.
No, there's some useful stuff. If you want to generate different slide layouts and formats and stuff, it's good to know.
I don't create all that many new slides anymore. What I'm trying to do now is essentially reduce the amount of text on all of my old slides. I have this ideal. One day I want to get down to where each slide just has a single icon, and each one will prompt me to speak for 5 or 10 minutes about whatever the icon represents. And what I'm curious to see is whether my students will actually take any notes at that point. I think they're kind of conditioned only to write down what is on a slide.
Yes, I know. I know the way that works. Yeah. My daughter says that if the lecturer doesn't give a handout at a class, you know, usually there's slides, and usually you get a copy of the slides and sometimes some notes, then people don't write anything. You know, they just expect this stuff to be fed to them, and then they sit there with their mouths open, as it were.
Yeah, I find that I don't just post the slides anymore for students to do that, or else they just don't do anything in class. I have certain students who, for like the Office of Disability has tested them, and they say these people need a note taker for class. And so for those students, I will offer them outline versions of my slides, but I don't just hand out the slides anymore because I want people to take notes.
Well, yeah, the way my daughter works is she takes an iPad in, and then she's got a note taking thing on that that she uses with a stylus. And then if there's slides to take away, she then goes and annotates them and makes copious notes on top of the slides or around the slides and that sort of stuff. So for her, it's actually quite good. But a load of people don't do that. You know, they just say, "Oh, I don't need to do any work. I can just go on, carry on."
She sounds like an ideal student.
She's keen. She's keen.
Very good.
Okay, let's get on to 1856.
I guess that's mine now. SSH right. Config by Klaatu. And that is the entire title. Hang on. And then he gives an example. He's talking about the config file. This is something I learned about maybe a couple of years ago. And man, what a difference that file made once I learned about it. So you can set up all these like aliases for all your hosts and store the login credentials, the port numbers, and all of that kind of stuff so that you don't have to type these very long, complicated commands. And so now I will do something like SSH Pi 2, and that will go into my second Raspberry Pi using the right credentials and all that. And I love it.
Yeah, that's good. I knew this existed, but I'd never actually bothered to delve into what it did. And I actually, in many cases, had command aliases to do it.
So that's how I used to do it too.
yeah. So having heard this, I thought, oh, I must look into this. And oh yeah, it's much better. I'm so glad that Klaatu did this. And I've configured a lot of mine that way now. So it's very, very convenient.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Not just for SSHing into things, but for secure copying. I mean, you can copy files over to your servers using these aliases, and man, it makes everything easier.
Yes, I know. I do that. I use SCP and stuff quite a lot. So it makes life considerably easier. Very good. Yeah,
there is a comment by Oxfuanzuri. He says, nice intro to /.ssh/config, Klaatu. He says the protocol 2 option is the default for quite some time, as in more than 10 years. I think the latest version of OpenSSH doesn't even compile with support for version 1 by default, at least the SSH daemon, or the server. Shortening host names comes really handy in cases like webfrontend.fancy-example-corp.co.uk. Boy, he's not kidding there. And there's also patterns matching he talks about pattern matching for host names, so *.fancy-example-corp. And so forth. And then he shows how to use a username and identity file and various other things. You should go read this comment if it sounds at all interesting. It's too difficult to read at all. Why don't you?
Okay, the next one was, next comment was from B. Yeezy, who says, thanks for this show. I immediately added a config file with a couple of accounts that I commonly use. The only thing I added for security is to change the permissions on the file to 600 or 644. So yeah, the only change that I added. Yeah, I think that must be what the word is.
Hang in there, man.
Keep up the great shows. Now, I was thrown by the fact he missed a word out there. I was trying to fill it in for him and failing miserably. So I should just shut up and get on with it.
Yeah, I think you are forced to change the file permissions to 600 if you're trying to do SSH logins. But I mean, because I've had situations where I had forgotten to do that before.
Yeah,
or maybe
I think
it's
you're
the key file. It might be the key file that you have to do that, but because it won't let you log in unless your permissions are set to 600.
I thought you had to be careful about the config file because that's potentially dangerous. I thought you
probably.
I've seen this somewhere, but I might be conflating it with the thing you said. I'm not sure.
I'm having trouble remembering right now too. It might have been one time where I, for the first time, tried to log in using a new key pair, and I'd forgotten to change the key files to 600 or something, and it aborted and said your permissions are not secure enough.
Okay, that's good. So do you want to do that last comment there, John?
Sure. Gabriel Evenfire comments, identity file. I'm curious if, from your example, you are creating separate identity files for each host. I imagine not, but it's a possibility I'd never considered before. I suppose it doesn't provide that much more security insofar as if someone can read one of your private keys from .ssh/, they can read all of them, but it does make me think. For my part, I have this Ruby script to run SSH with shorthands to the different identities and accounts in our internal machines. This show is prompting me to do it the right way, especially insofar as it will work with secure copy, secure FTP, and scripts that use them. Thanks for the show. I'm enjoying that people are starting to break open the tools other than the blade in this SSH Swiss Army knife. And I had never really thought about creating a separate key pair for each server that I use either.
No,
is this something that you do?
No, I've never done that. Never occurred to me why I would need to do it, to be honest.
Nor me either. Something to think about, I suppose, but I don't really know.
So, okay. Next show then, 1857, Adventures in Coffee by C-Prompt, Curtis Adkins. And another one in the series, the great series on coffee. I'm not sure we've had enough to make a series yet, but maybe we should. And C-Prompt's talking about his French press, which is very interesting, and the way he gets his coffee from. In fact, he uses a creamer too, which good. I was impressed by the links and the various resources he uses. They look really good.
Yeah, we have a French press, but I haven't used it in quite a while. And in fact, I think my wife took it to her office so that she could make French press coffee there. We have probably 6 or 7 different ways to make coffee in the house here. And I like French press, you know, as long as you grind it coarse enough so it doesn't get too gritty. And I like the fact that he talked about the temperature of the water and how that affected the taste of the coffee too. I used to have a travel French press mug where you just drank right out of the thing itself. I think it was actually Bodum that made that as well, but it was a little travel mug that was a French press.
That sounds very good. I like the sound of that. Yeah. There's quite a variety of different devices like that. I'm sure I've been in some restaurant where they maybe gave everybody an individual French press or something and a cup or something. I can't remember now.
It's
quite cool. So Gabriel Evenfire comments, nice episode even for non-coffee people. I'm not a coffee person. I've tried. I can't seem to acquire the taste. Definitely prefer teas. But it was nevertheless entertaining to hear the process you go through. I've heard people talk, rave actually, about French presses before, but never had a clue as to why they were useful. Hearing the process, I can start to imagine why. Thanks for the show.
Very nice. Comment number 2, posted by Dave Morris. He says, I enjoyed this a lot. I like the relaxed style and the detailed content. Not used my French presses, or cafetières, as we prefer to call them, for a while. I prefer to use my mocha pot and brew a large, strong coffee every morning. After listening to this, I had a craving for coffee, so made some with some Kenya medium ground I had all but abandoned in the freezer. It was great, but that's double my normally daily intake. Gotta watch it there, Dave.
I know. I shall be shaking before I know what's happened. That's true, though. It's something about listening to people talking about coffee that make you think, oh, yeah, I could just drink coffee now. I did that very thing. I don't use a French press very often. I've got a metal insulated one. which is really good. Keep the coffee warm after you've made it. So that got some use.
We used one of those when we were traveling last summer. We stayed at a bed and breakfast place that had one of those metal French presses that was insulated, and that made really nice coffee.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. And Michael made a comment saying, "You got my European mind. Congrats, you got me for a long moment." Which is an interesting way of saying he was deeply puzzled. Water at 200 degrees, huh?
Yeah.
After it finally dawned on me, I consulted an online converter to learn that 200 degrees Fahrenheit means 93.3 centigrade, which made a lot more sense to me. So, that wonderful
stuff. I guess it would.
Fahrenheit centigrade problems all the time. Otherwise, I second Gabriel above. Thanks for the show. So that's good. I like that.
You know what? The problem for me with the water temperature is that it's too difficult to get it just right. Like I would like to have a water heater upper that just goes to the right coffee temperature, because we have the electric tea kettle that it boils it. And I suppose you could turn it off before it gets to the boiling point, but which is the right point? And we've got a thermometer, but man, I just can't be bothered to be doing all that to make sure the water is at the right temperature.
No, it's a tremendously complicated process, isn't it? I just happened yesterday when I was just wanting to relax for a bit. I got the Wikipedia page on coffee up on my tablet. I was sitting there reading this, and the detail that they go into there about, you know, coffee, where coffee comes from and how you make it, and all of the complexities of what comes out when and what different roasts and stuff. It's amazing. You could write PhDs galore on that, I'm sure.
Oh, you surely could. Somebody probably has, I would think.
It's probably happened, yeah. Yeah, true.
Right, so episode 1858, another one of my favorite ones here, Multimeter Mods Part 2 by NY Bill. And in this one, he talks about more modification. He finishes the mods that he started in an earlier episode to his knockoff multimeter. Well, I think that's putting it in negatively to say it's a knockoff multimeter. He just says that it's a very high-quality multimeter that's not quite commercial grade like the one he uses for work.
Yeah, I was impressed with its description of it, because he's also done a review of it, hasn't he? Is that in the past or in the future? I'm not sure.
I think it's coming up.
It's coming up, yeah. But I was impressed with it. In fact, I'm quite tempted. You can buy them here as well. I'm quite tempted to get one. So I just have a cheap multimeter at the moment, which is quite like something with a bit more quality to it, even though that is not professional quality, certainly high enough quality for my needs.
Yeah, I've got one. I don't even know how much mine costs, because my dad bought it for me as a birthday present or something. And it seems fine for me, but I don't think it has all the features that the Bill's talking about this one having.
Yeah, it's tempting. But I was very impressed with what he was doing with it. It's quite a tale he was telling here of a bit of a a faux pas, if you like, going on there, cutting the hole in the wrong side was the sort of thing you would just go, oh no, and you'd just sort of throw it out the window, perhaps. But he managed not to do that and carried on and 3D printed a thing to fill the hole in, which I thought was just amazing. That's a brilliant piece of work.
I love that. It's one of those examples of messing something up, and then instead of being angry, thinking, what an opportunity. I can learn some 3D printing and some CAD and stuff. So, man, love this episode.
Well, somebody made the comment that we could do with the show on the 3D. I don't know if that's following on later on, but the fact that he taught himself how to do this in Blender and then got his friend to print these things out was just fantastic. I like this very much.
Me too. So my comment was the first one. I say, another amazing tale of ingenuity. Well done, Bill. I loved this episode. Especially enjoyed the inadvertent detour into CAD and 3D printing. Of course, the process of designing and printing 3D model is good for another episode, ...
Very good. Yes. And Mike Ray followed with the comment, hacking at its best. Great stuff. Hacking at its best. Heard the names of some old friends too. 2N3904, 2N2222, etc., etc. These are not old friends to me, but I know what he's saying.
Yeah, I don't know those guys either. NY Bill responds, "Thanks, John. Yeah, that detour into 3D design and printing was interesting. A friend from our lug, Jason, bought a 3D printer about 8 months ago. A-Sphere was interested in it and asked lots of questions. He then designed a part for one of his model rockets and asked if Jason could print it. Before I knew it, A-Sphere bought his own 3D printer kit. And while designing my parts, I asked A-Sphere, is this how it all starts? I'll want my own 3D printer soon." Of course, that's how it starts, Bill.
Well, why would you not? I mean, yes. And NY Bill also comments back to Mike saying, yep, those old two ends, one of those, if it ain't broke, don't fix it parts. Yes.
Yes, it means they still do the same job they've always done and do it perfectly fine.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that these guys are starting to talk code to one another here. And
like transistor nerds or something.
Yeah.
So there are a couple more comments here. Mirwee titles his comment Splitting Hair. I agree on old friends for the 2N3904 and 2N2222. However, I can't resist to add that these are, unlike the 2N7000, not MOSFETs, but NPM BJTs, bipolar junction transistors. The point being that BJTs need some amount of control current at the base in contrast to the virtually zero current at the gate of a MOSFET. Judging from the linked pictures, you have compensated for that by using a bigger capacitor to get the desired turn-on time. In any case, thanks a lot for sharing this journey. Okay, I didn't understand very much of that there, but...
No. Well, it is, you know, the cognoscenti are discussing these things that us mere mortals have to just sort of stand in the sidelines and listen to, I guess.
Yep.
NY Bill replied to Mirwee saying... transistors. I started with a MOSFET, but it wasn't doing what I wanted. So I experimented with the transistors I had on hand and chose the one that worked best for me. However, I can't remember if I went into detail about the part change between episode 1 and 2. Thanks for the clarification. You know, an episode on the finer points of transistors might make a fine HBR. Thanks, NY Bill. That's a good one. We need more of those comments.
Yep. And finally, Mike Ray makes another comment. Sadly, some of the old friend through-hole mounting transistors are beginning to disappear, or at least be very hard to find. And those that are still there are rising in price, I guess, to reflect the smaller numbers in which they're made. It's getting almost impossible to find the good old 2N3819 MOSFET I used to use to make oscillators, and even workhorses like the BC107/8/9 transistors are getting ridiculously expensive over here in the UK. Anybody remember scraping the paint off the body of an OCR45 to make phototransistors?
Sorry, no. I dare say some people do.
Very nice.
Right.
So I guess you're up now?
Yep. Sorry, I'm just juggling between pressing the button and clicking to the next page. Too much behind the scenes here. Sorry about that. So this is 1859, A Mouse in a Maze on the Raspberry Pi by Gabriel Evenfire. And this is him talking about bare metal programming on the Raspberry Pi, and it's continuing on from some of his earlier stuff, very detailed stuff.
Yeah, I'm interested, but I don't really understand very much of it, I'm sad to say. But I always like hearing what people are doing with their Raspberry Pis. I mean, that itself could be a series, I would think.
Yeah. No, it's interesting stuff. It's hard to get into unless you have that sort of background. I mean, if you've done a degree in computer science, you might well have covered some of these sorts of things, but I haven't, and so my knowledge in this area is more sort of peripheral in many ways. So
yeah,
I did, when I worked at my previous job. It was in the era when microprocessors, as they were then called, were appearing, and there was a team in our department who was building there was a competition, I'm not sure if it was just in the UK, called the Micro Mouse Competition, where you had to produce a mouse-shaped robot that physically went through a physical maze to find a piece of cheese. And they were doing this on using processes like 6502 and that type of stuff. I wasn't sufficiently knowledgeable about how to do that in those days, but was very deeply interested in what they were doing. So this reminds me of that.
Yeah, it sounds pretty cool, but like I said, I can't really follow a lot of what he's talking about there. There was one comment by Mike Ray entitled "Welcome Return." Great episode, Gabriel, and great to see you back with more bare metal programming. Looking forward to episodes about sound rendering on the GPU.
Wow, yes, yeah, quite. Be interested to hear that.
All right, so the next episode, 1860, is that it? Yeah, 5150 interviews Chris Wade of Save Wi-Fi. And this is the one where they're talking about new FCC regulations and the potential consequences for open source operating systems and for the firmware that many of us like to load onto our routers.
Yeah, this is it's a pretty scary prospect, I think, isn't it? The fact that, yeah, there's a potential issue with software-defined radios being used to do things that more fixed hardware was being used for in the past is opening doors that weren't open before. And if I understand it, this is sort of a bureaucratic response to that, which is to say, you know, ban it, control it, stop yeah. it, or, you know, rather than a more controlled response. And it's, I think Chris Wade made some very excellent points about the stupidity of this response by the FCC. But it's going to have worldwide ramifications as well, which is very, very worrying.
Yeah, well, for my own part, I'm not planning on changing the firmware on any of my routers, all of which run DDWRT on them. Until I hear otherwise, I'm just going to keep running them.
Sure, yeah. I'm sure that's the case, but it's more that new stuff will be restricted in this way, and eventually, if it actually happens, it will spread to all sorts of places, because, you know, there's so much stuff that could potentially have this sort of software-defined radio equipment in it, including laptops and anything with Wi-Fi on it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, there are no comments for that episode.
Okay, so moving on to 1861. This was Curtis Adkins, C-Prompt, who was doing another in his series of cool stuff. This is part four, and he was talking about three main topics. CMUS, CMUS, is that what it's called? CMUS?
Command I've never used player. It, but yeah.
I know, I've not used it. I've used MPC and MPD and some of the things that work around that, but not that particular one.
Mm-hmm.
And recommending a podcast, Song Exploder, and musicians take apart their songs.
That sounds pretty cool, actually. I've not explored that podcast, but I remember thinking while he was talking about it that's a genius idea for a podcast.
Yeah, it's, I'm sure it's interesting. I've not followed it up. And the third one was Mr. Robot, which is a TV show, I believe. Certainly heard of it. Not seen it, though.
I haven't either. Maybe I should try it out, though, because my wife and I are having a real problem finding any TV series to watch. We'll watch one episode and then just can't be bothered anymore, and we just read our books.
Well, yeah, it's a funny thing, actually, without digressing too far. When my kids were here, before they went off to university and stuff, we reached the point between us that we just got so bored with TV. And that was 2013. The TV's not been switched on since. Nobody wanted to watch it, you know. There's plenty of other places you can read. You can go on the internet. There's so much other stuff. We have not watched the television in that time, because the amount of stuff that we actually enjoyed amongst the what was available was tiny. Why bother? Really was the answer.
We found a few series that we like, but then they're the sorts of series that are over after, say, six or eight episodes, and then there's no follow-up, and so then we are left looking around for more. And I've always got a book going, and I like reading just as much. But the only thing I always watch on TV is the whatever American football games are on, and I'll watch those. But otherwise, I'd rather just read my book.
I think it's a common response these days. I know loads of people who see the world in that sort of way. So it's good,
yep.
Personally. But
all right, let's move on. another one of the cool stuff episodes where Ken might say that you could make three episodes out of the one.
So that's always true. Yeah, yeah.
All right. So are you up next? I forgot already.
No, I did last one, I think, didn't I?
Okay.
Yes.
So 1862, The Awesomely Epic Guide to KDE, Part 1, and then the next day is Part 2. And in this one, the new host, Geddes, contributes his very first show, and he talks about the KDE desktop. And I found it very, very interesting. I've tried KDE two or three times in the years that I've been running Linux, and it has never stuck. There are certain things I really like about it, like the Kate text editor I think is excellent, but overall I just have never found it all that interesting. But I liked hearing him talk about all the various ways to tweak it to make it better.
Yeah, I know it was a great idea to do a show on this, to be going through an article like this. The article was brilliant, of course, but it's a great idea to do this because it's a good way to consume that sort of thing, I think, and it's fascinating.
Oh, right.
Material.
I had forgotten. So he did not write this article, but he had made the audio recording for Linux Voice. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he got their permission to put it up on HPR as well. So
yeah, which I enjoyed great. That.
Yeah, I thought it was a brilliant idea. I really enjoyed listening to this. I am I have been a KDE user actually for a long time.
Yeah, I thought so.
I started on Red Hat Linux back in the 90s, and then it turned into Fedora, and KDE must have appeared in that sort of era. And I just moved to that rather than the GNOME because GNOME seemed very primitive. So I just stuck with it ever since. Until now, I'm not on it anymore because Debian testing breaks it all the damn time. So, so I'm currently using XFCE, which is more basic, but it's more stable. So
yeah. Well, I'm on OpenBox with Tint 2, and it's much more basic even than XFCE, but I like it very much.
Yeah, I used to use CrunchBang on one of my machines and had OpenBox on that. Yeah, it's good. It does the job.
Yep. So there's one comment by Ken Fallon. He says, I just enabled a load of these. Hi, Geddes. I just re-enabled a load of these. I didn't bother before as I mostly did reinstalls, but then I realized that I could keep my config in my home dir so it would move with me. Excellent reading and a great idea. I guess he's referring there to the idea of taking this audio from something else and then presenting it as an HPR episode.
Yeah, I think it is a good idea. It's and Linux Voice products are always worth hearing again, I think.
Sure, especially for those of us who found Linux Voice too expensive to subscribe to.
That's a shame. That's a pity. So if we hop across to the next episode, there's not much more to say about the content, but yeah. there's a comment from John Culp who says, probably still will not switch to KDE, but I really enjoyed both of these episodes about tweaking KDE, although I would probably still not adopt the desktop myself. This also is a pretty good idea to read old magazine articles that are still of current interest as HPR episodes with some intro up front, as long as it doesn't run afoul of any licensing, which we know it doesn't. So, yeah.
Good deal.
Great idea. Good way to join HPR, too.
Yep.
Okay, so who's on? Oh, it's me next, is it? Shall I do this one?
You some can do geezer, your own episode there.
Some geezer called Dave Morris did a thing. Turning an old printer into a network printer. This was me trying to make my old printer work. I think somebody commented on Oddcast Planet. I just saw the comment when I logged in the other day that old is 10 years. Well, yeah. It's a way of describing it. I do actually have an even older printer, which is from the 1980s, but it's a serial laser printer. So I want to get that working at some stage. But I think I might be in for a struggle there.
It's funny. Anyway. I remember when my dad got his first laser printer, I think it was an HP LaserJet 4. And I want to say he paid nearly $3,000 for that thing.
Yeah, I can believe that. They were very expensive.
Yeah, that was about 1990.
Well, we bought laser printers for our VAX cluster, which we bought in 1987 at the university I was working at. And when it was junked, then the laser printers were still working. So, and they were going to get thrown out. And I said, oh, I'll have one. But
sure,
you try lifting it. Wow. It weighs a ton. And it's only a sort of desktop thing. But
that's funny.
It's amazingly heavy. It's made of lead or something. I'm not sure what it is, but it's concrete. I have no idea.
Maybe it's a security feature, so nobody runs off with it.
Yeah. Anyway, the point of this show was I was doing this and getting it to work, and I'm a terrible note taker. I have to write things down, otherwise I forget them. So I wrote lots and lots of notes in my wiki, and I suddenly thought, oh, wow, I could make this a show. So I did.
Sure.
So you got my notes effectively. Slightly
very
changed.
Good.
So anyway.
Yeah, I liked that episode, and I commented as much, saying, whoa, remote scanning. Very cool, Dave. I've got an old printer on the network too, but hooked up to my Goodwill router via USB. The advantage of using a Raspi is the remote scanning. I never even knew that was possible at all. Thought you always had to hook up with a USB to scan stuff. Then again, I never really thought about it that much. Usually, I walk over to the university library to do my scanning, because they have awesome scanners for public use. Thanks for another great episode.
Oh, thanks, John. And that's what I said in response. Thanks, John. I like that. I like that routers can run printers like this. It's a great idea, but I suspect the features are limited. I do have a router that can do it, but I haven't tried it. I have plans to experiment with cups, perhaps configuring other queues for different size stationery, for example. Just as an aside, we used to run cups at work back in the day, so I have a little bit of experience playing around with it. Oh, I commented here about my DEC LNO3 monochrome laser printer, circa 1987.
Ah,
yeah. I don't know how to make a Raspberry Pi talk serial RS-232 to a printer, but that would be quite an interesting thing to do. I'm sure it must be possible. So, yeah, the scanning capability is good to have, and it's been used more than I would have expected. Quality is not particularly high, but it's good enough for most purposes.
Sounds fine.
So,
man, look at me yawning here at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Well, we're getting close to the end, I think, are we?
Yeah, next episode is, we got four more episodes here.
Yeah.
Next one is number 62 in the LibreOffice Impress, or the LibreOffice series. This is Impress Working with Text Boxes by Ahuka.
Yeah, so this is a follow-on from the previous one, actually making your slides with your own text boxes to put them where you want and have as many as you want and so forth. I'd never actually done this. Didn't even know it was possible. But as usual, Ahuka does the great thing of giving us lots of information, especially on his own site there, and leading us along the way to the answers to this. So very good. Thank you.
Well, this episode really helps to explain some confusing things about the way Impress behaves. When you think you ought to be applying a text style, you really ought to be applying a drawing object style. I mean, it really is counterintuitive when you're using the program, and here he kind of breaks it down and tells you which styles you really need to be using if you want it to work right. So it's very helpful.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. Yeah, it is a rather strange beastie, this thing. It's to make it do what you want to do. It's not entirely obvious. I've certainly seen people try and use slide presentation systems as if they are typing a document, and
oh, that's awful.
Yeah, and then it flows from one slide to another and makes a hell of a mess and so on and so forth. So it's good to understand it better in this way, I think.
Yep, there were no comments, so on to 1866.
So this was Kuvmo. Is that Kuvmo? Is that how you say it? Kuvmo? Who was talking... An Awkward Talk with Two Young Computer Users is his title, and he talks to his children, Eric and Emily, talking about operating systems, school, and fun uses of computers. So I love that.
I thought it was nice. I didn't think it was that awkward.
No, absolutely. No, it's the way, you know, it's the way these things go. I think it just seemed very natural and relaxed. It was good. And they were certainly... The two kids were very, very forthcoming with their thoughts and opinions.
Yeah, I enjoy that, because my kids are 1 year off of their ages. My kids are 14 and 11, and they would have had somewhat similar responses, although I think it sounds like my son has a bit more experience in the programming part of it. It sounded like he was trying to get his son to show a little bit more interest in programming, and yes. I wasn't sure he really wanted it.
yes. I think he hadn't quite delved far enough into it yet to understand what was entailed, but there you go.
That's fine.
Fair enough. And Frank, I don't know which Frank this was, commented on the show. Was it Frank Bell, perhaps?
Probably Frank Bell. Yeah, I don't know many Franks that listen to us and who comment. No.
And he said, absolutely delightful, which I can't but agree with.
Yeah, it was great. So the next day was my episode called the Lafayette Public Library Makerspace. And this was one that was made over a series of days. I think there are three separate segments here. One ending in bitter disappointment and another longer segment where I got just awesome help from the librarian on duty in the makerspace. And then I finally come back and give a little roundup and talk about the results of the printing. Basically what I was doing was trying to get in there and make use of the 3D printers and other things that they have in the newly renovated downtown public library in Lafayette, Louisiana.
Yeah, what a place. It sounds really, really good. I was so glad you told us about it. You're very lucky. I don't know that there's places quite of that caliber in the UK.
I don't really know either. This is the only one of the public library branches that's got a makerspace. Now, we do have a new branch of the library. Well, I say new, but it was probably built 7 or 8 years ago. And it has lots of excellent things in it, but I just like how they... When they were renovating this downtown library, they thought of so many things. Like they thought of the makerspace. And I also liked the fact that it's not just for technology, but also for more traditional making arts, like knitting and sewing and things like that, where you can go in there and use these sewing machines or sit around with other people and knit a scarf or something. It's really very cool.
Yeah, somebody with quite a lot of foresight must have thought this through. How would that have been done? Do you know? Is there some sort of a community group that comes up with these ideas?
Well, I know that there is I don't know if it's a board of directors or something like that, but I'm actually friends with one of the people who's a sort of official in the Lafayette Public Library, and she may have had something to do with it. They also hired a very good architecture firm to handle the design of the interior renovation and everything. The exterior of the building didn't change a lot, but it has some additions. The interior is almost completely different, and it's really, really well done. It took them 4 or 5 years to get it done, but man, it's awesome now.
Yeah, it sounds well worth the wait from what you describe. It's really good. The only thing I wondered about was maybe they didn't quite get the opening times sorted before it became available. That was the only sort of slight downside. I'm sure they will soon get it organized, but it seemed a little bit lacking there.
Well, yeah, I mean, I talked to I cut out the part of the podcast where the librarian explained to me why they weren't there on that day when I first went, and it had to do with personal reasons for her, and so I decided to cut that out. It was very valid excuse, but I think they've got it stabilized now. And she told me that they're starting to have lots of groups going and scheduling classes and stuff like that. So I think it's going to be very well used.
Yeah. Sure. I heard the bit where she said there were classes coming in and stuff, which will be fantastic. What a resource! That's really good.
Yeah, very it's like I said, a great public quality of life enhancement for the city.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, so next was me again. Although it wasn't really me, I just posted the show for the group, and this was the 1868 Glasgow Pod Crawl, or Pod Crawl Glasgow, maybe it should have been, whatever. Kevy Sink puts it the other way around when he refers to it.
Okay.
So Kevy was the organizer of the Pod Crawl, really. He and McNallow, Andrew Conway, but It was a fun time. I thought there might be a few more people, but the fact we had Andrew Gregory from Linux Voice come along to join us as well was very good indeed. So that was good. And it's a good idea to come back and chat about it. I thought it was It was fun to get together and chat.
Yeah, it was really nice hearing Andrew Gregory's voice again. I've not listened to any of his podcasts since, what was it? Was it the Ubuntu UK pod? What podcast did he do before Linux Voice?
He did. He was on Linux Format, and their podcast was called Tux Radar, I think, was it?
Tux Radar, yeah. I listened to both of those.
Yeah, yeah. So, they have a... They have a really nice, relaxed way of doing their podcasts, which is always quite amusing. And he's I think partly down to Andrew, but I'm sure the others contribute a lot as well. But it's cool.
It was fun hearing you guys sitting around talking. It reminded me a little bit of the Duffercast.
Yeah. There was some commonality there, I suspect.
I'm getting a little bit distracted right now. My daughter is outside singing La Vie en Rose in a very loud voice. She and her friend are rehearsing because they're supposed to sing this at an upcoming event at her school. I think the French immersion program is doing some kind of thing. And so I'm hearing you, but I'm also hearing her singing outside my window. It's very distracting.
Yeah, it's rather fun. It's not coming through very well. I just caught just the edge of it, but your mic must be quite directional or something.
Well, yeah. It's a condenser mic. But it is outside, so I'm in the detached office, which is not connected to the house. But she was out on the back patio there singing, and it's really funny.
Very good, very good. Yeah, I sometimes when I do these, my daughter's here if it's vacation and stuff, and she occasionally forgets and makes noises in the background, but. Not singing. That hasn't happened yet.
It's good to get a little atmosphere there.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so mailing list discussions.
Yep, I'm just changing gear quickly. So, what we normally do is to talk about what's been happening on the mailing list. And the notes are set up. But what happens, if you're not aware of it, is that when stuff gets posted to the HPR mailing list, it also gets copied to the Gmane service and is available there as well. So what I do is I scan that and link to the various things for the notes. But I have a suspicion that Gmane is having a problem today. When I tried it earlier on, I wasn't actually able to get through to it. So just hold on a second while I check again.
I'm actually trying to grab one right now, and it's just spinning. It's not loading up.
Yeah, I'm seeing the same here. It's a great service. It's a free service, but I don't know whether he gets attacked, the guy who runs this, whether he gets attacked or whether he's maybe just gets overloaded or what exactly happens to it.
Maybe let's view this as an opportunity to have a shorter community news.
Yeah, I think that the... going into minute detail with the email might be excessive. I don't know. We can probably skim through it fairly quickly. The time I did this on my own at this show a while back, what I did was I summarized the mail for myself and just quickly skimmed through it and said here were the main topics without drilling down, because you can always drill down yourself to see the details. And if you're an HPR subscriber, then you probably are on the mailing list anyway. And if not, you maybe ought to be. The other thing I should say is that mailing list is run with the Mailman list software. And Mailman can keep its own archives of messages, which it threads and variously keeps in order. We used to have a problem with this, and I think that's why Ken moved over to Gmane. But since we've moved across to an Honest Host, the new Mailman installation has fixed all of the problems that we had with the archive. So the archive is completely intact now, as far as I can see. So if you can't get through to Gmane, you can just click on the link to the Mailman mailing list site and click on the link to archive, and you'll see all of the messages there. So there's multiple strings to the bow there.
Sounds good.
I used to administer a Mailman system for the university I worked at, so feels like home from home in many respects. Anyway, the main topics on the main list then briefly are, there was some discussion about using Markdown for show notes. That was one of the earliest subjects that came up, with some chat about the different versions of Markdown that might be available and possibly some other markup languages being used. I don't think we've reached too much of a conclusion. I think the view that Ken and I hold is that we'll take whatever you send us. We'd really, really like it if you could send us something which was a known markup format. And if you tell us what it is, that would be great. We don't have a mechanism for doing that yet, but you can just put it in the top of the show notes, as a few people have done, yourself included, John.
Right.
And I'm writing some stuff to help with the processing of this into HTML. If you feel that you're able to generate good quality HTML5, then go for it, and that's the best option. But we'd prefer not to have to debug it. So we'd like it to be good quality, please.
Yeah, I mean, I tried Markdown for the first time on this the latest episode that I uploaded, and it seemed like everything worked fine, except for the image links were messed up by whatever version of Markdown. Are you the one that handled that?
I actually processed the one. Ken does most of the processing on the back end, though we're trying to work it out that we can divide up the load, but we haven't got there yet. So, but in this particular case, I ran my test script against your notes, and it said, this is Markdown. So it went and ran Pandoc on it. But what I hadn't realized was that it was running Pandoc in its Pandoc mode, which does slightly different things to standard Markdown. So it messed it up, which you pointed out, and I then fixed it. But so it's a learning process. It's still discovering things about this. So
yeah, but you said that there was a flag that you could use on the command line that would tell it to run in some kind of a different mode.
Yeah, when you run Pandoc, there's umpteen. Oh, you mean in the notes themselves? No, or you mean on the command line?
On Pandoc.
Yeah, there are umpteen options to Pandoc. So you can say, I think this is plain Markdown, or it's Pandoc enhanced Markdown, or it's GitHub style Markdown, and many others.
Heaven help us.
Yeah, it's a brilliant bit of software. It seems to have written very, very well, as far as I can see. I haven't found too many problems with it.
But the one that worked for mine was something like strict mode or something?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
You just switch off the Pandoc extensions.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going by the documentation over at Daring Fireball as far as how to insert images.
Yeah. No, that's fine. Like I say, we're still learning. It was my fault. I didn't quite appreciate that it was going to do that.
Yeah, well, you fixed it.
So another thread that we had was concerning the menus on the website. And Mike Ray had pointed out that the menus that we have are not accessible to him because he can't hover over them and get the sort of spoken feedback that he needs. And the reason for that is because we're using the hover facility, the hover capability to drop down stuff to make it look like a menu. And so I think Ken commented back on this, that he was off to look to see what could be done to improve it. And he came back saying that it was going to be really, really difficult and could do with some help on that. So it's that balance between HTML and CSS and how those two things hook into screen readers and all of those types of things, I think.
I wonder if Mike could, depending on what browser he's using, like if he's using Firefox, it's extremely easy to just disable all styling, and that would open up the menus to his screen reader, it would seem to me.
Yeah, I'm not sure of the details of this. I think the way that the HTML underneath has been put together means that it relies on the fact that there are there's going to be a CSS that responds in particular ways to drop down lists and open up lists and stuff. So I'm not clear whether that would do the job, or whether it would be better just to have a different version of the main page. I don't know. I don't. I'm no expert on this at all. So I can't really comment much.
It sounds like a good reason to try the page in W3M.
That's true. Yeah. So it's an ongoing thing, I think. And help is requested from people who might know how to better ways of solving this. So another thing we had on the list was we seem to have an issue with the mailing list itself. This is a bit sort of behind the scenes, but what seemed to be happening was that when Ken was trying to send a message out about, which I'll come on to in a minute, about more contributions needed, please, he was sending some attachments. The attachments, the message went to Mailman. Mailman apparently did the right thing and sent it out to everybody, but it looks as if the anti-spam stuff on the server then killed it. Because the reason I say that is because the message in its intact form was in the archive, and in a reduced form was in the digest, because I subscribed to the digest just to make sure that it works. The digest form of the list, digest always strips out the attachments and points to them on the website, and that worked. So it was just the one with the actual attachments that was being stopped. So I think that's been solved, but we were trying to test it. So that's what all that was about.
Okay. Yeah, I'll be honest, I kind of ignored that whole thread.
Probably I should have ignored it too, really, shouldn't I? So yeah. And then the issue of getting contributions was had a lot of discussion. The threading in these notes hasn't worked very well because a lot of people did digest replies and stuff and broke the threads.
Yeah, so, I see a number of digest things here.
Yeah, I shall try not to nag, even though I did do a show on how not to do that. But anyway, hold me back. But the point of it was that Ken's view was that you owe us a show. He said you owe us a show. If you've ever been a contributor, or if you're a listener even, you owe us a show. But it was pointed out by Lost in Bronx in a response that I didn't completely absorb when he wrote it, that maybe that wasn't quite the approach that we should be taking. And thinking about it, I think he was right. It was more that it's a community. We, in order for the show, the whole community structure of HBR to continue, we need contributions. But you don't owe us a show. It's just that we desperately need your help.
Yeah.
So the difference in sort of trying to, I don't think anybody was ever trying to make anybody feel guilty about not contributing, but it might have come across
somebody
that
might
way.
Have been.
Yeah, well, it might have come across that way. So I think the point is, and Ken responded to this saying, yeah, okay, that's not quite the way that we want to do it. We still need them. We still need the shows, please. But it's more that if you want the project to continue, then we need your contribution, please.
Yeah, well, we did get a new host this month, and we could use a few more. I'm going to say my episode contributions are probably going to go down this fall. I've got a number of things going on, and so it'd be great if some other people could step in there and upload some more shows.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there were one or two comments about you don't need to worry about the quality, and don't think you sound stupid because it's just you who thinks that, not the rest of the world, and so on and so forth.
I would say I think people should worry at least a little bit about the sound quality. I want to be able to listen without hearing distortion. That's my main thing.
Yes. Do your best. But don't be frightened that it's terrible. Unless it really is terrible. Mostly it's not. mostly
there have it, been There've been a couple of episodes where I had to turn it off because there was so much distortion. But yes. As far as worrying about the way your own voice sounds, don't worry about that at all. I would say I just want to hear people talk.
I know, but there is a terrible embarrassment that first time you ever record your voice.
Sure.
The voice you've heard all your life coming through your head to your ears, and all of a sudden you hear it coming from the outside world to your ears, and it's totally different, and it sounds awful.
It is.
But everybody else has heard it that way all the time, so what are you worrying about? So, you know, I sympathize with that viewpoint. So
yep.
Get over it. It's not such a big deal. What we want to know is the interesting stuff that you have to tell us. And if you listen to any of HBR, you'll get some idea of the sort of things that we get to listen to. And it's all fantastic. So just add your bit to that, please.
Yep.
Okay, let's call a halt to the mail business. And I think
sounds good.
We've pretty much covered the comments. We changed the way that we do the comments a wee bit, because we used to wait till the end of everything at this point and then go through all the comments. In some cases, it was going back to shows we'd already looked at and doing the comments. What we're doing now is we're just going through all the comments as we go along. The only bit that we don't cover by that means is where somebody in the month of September has made a comment to an older show. And so we need to maybe just check if there are any of those before we call, we get to the end of that particular bit. And there was one, 5150 made a comment to Lost in Bronx for his Theatre of the Imagination Part 7 show, where he was talking about the Zoom H1, I think it was it? And a Tascam. And I think 5150 was happy that that comparison had been done, because he went out and bought himself a Zoom.
Yep, and then a guy named Rob Blaine made a comment on my HPR 1750, which was where I talked about XClip, XDO Tool, and XVKBD, and how I use them in conjunction with Blather. And I was really glad to hear that he is using Blather, although I'm sad to hear that it's because he also has a medical issue. It said he's got a dystonia or something, and so it's... I hate hearing about anybody suffering from those things, but I'm really glad that Blather's helping him out.
Indeed. We had a... These are not easy to follow, or is it just me? We had a comment on 1831 back in August, which was a Shadowy Figures show. No, we covered these last time, though, didn't we? I think we did. See, here's where it gets a little confusing, because what we did was we reviewed that particular show, 1831, last month, and the comment had already... No, it can't have already been made, because it was made in the following month.
Well, it says it's September 7th.
Yeah. So it was a further comment. It was comment number 5 to 1831, which was Shadowy Figures show on speed listening. And this was Folky, who came back and was commenting on the speeds of German-speaking podcasts and Swedish-speaking podcasts and English. And the different speeds.
But, I like that. It hadn't really occurred to me that you would have different speeds for different languages, but it totally makes sense, I suppose, depending on your fluency in the different languages.
Yeah. I find I can't speed English up very much these days. It's probably because my brain's slowing down or something. I don't know what it is. But it's old age catch up with me. But anyway, it's an interesting thing. It's an interesting subject. But... good for people who can do it. I certainly can't. Is that it?
That might be about it, yeah. There's some things on NY Bill's HPR 1846. That was in August. That was that was the review. Remember, we had wondered about the review of that multimeter? That was his review show.
It was August. Yeah. Because the last community news was actually in September, wasn't it? Because just the way these things panned out. Some of these comments had already come in. I think the David Whitman's comment hadn't, maybe at that particular time.
Okay.
David Whitman said, it takes me a minute to open these things up. Hold on a second. Damn you, he says. These good buys that NY Bill keeps bringing up are causing me to spend dollars. bought two of the X61s and love them. And now this, actually need the ability to test capacitors. This can save a bundle. Just ask Flying Rich who lost a bundle.
Okay.
Yes, that's, I'm not sure everybody will get that comment. I'm not even sure I do, but...
Well, I guess what he's saying is all these bargains get pretty expensive.
Yes. Well, the Flying Rich reference was, I think, that the Bitcoin... Do you not have a Bitcoin problem?
I don't know anything about Flying Rich. I don't know who that is.
It's one of the TLLTS presenters who was into Bitcoin at one time. So I think that's it, because now we're 1847, we've already covered. So that's it. We need to actually make it easier to keep a record of what we have covered in the way of comments and what not. I need to do a better job of this. I thought I'd got this one down, but obviously not.
I think it worked okay.
Yeah, it's better than it was. Right, I think we've nearly finished. I've just got one, maybe two more things to say. One is that we put out a request for help with the tags, the missing tags and summaries on older shows. And over the past month, we had one helper who came along and helped out with these. This is a guy whose handle is Colin6128. I don't think he's a host yet. Hope maybe he will think of doing a show for us. But he certainly was extremely helpful in doing 40 or more tag and summary additions to the various shows in the database. So just wanted to make it plain that make a public vote of thanks for Colin6128 and his help in this regard.
Very nice.
So yeah, that was super. I was very pleased that we got that. The only other thing was that Ken and I have been putting HPR shows up on archive.org for a while now. So from episode 1300 forward, most of them have gone up. And then before that, we had problems because it wasn't easy to get hold of the high quality versions of the shows. Well, we discovered that we're probably never going to get the high quality, so we're just going to go with what quality we have. So we're just starting the process of uploading the numbers backwards from 1300. So the range 1200 to 1299 I'm working on at the moment. So if just in case you've got shows in those ranges and you're interested in them being on archive.org, we're actually in the process of doing that for posterity. So,
well, I should have, for my own shows anyway, I think I've still got the high quality for all of them. For mine, I'd be happy to supply that.
Okay.
And by the way, I want to thank you publicly also for working on that and also for handling the pictures on my episodes that have gone missing since one of my servers crashed. So thanks for taking care of that.
You're very welcome. We need to get a better method of ensuring that we don't lose links and pictures and that type of thing. Sometimes links are just not going to ever be there again for older shows.
Yeah.
But we at very least need to be looking to see if there are copies on the Wayback Machine, various things, and linking them, bringing them onto the HBR site and those sorts of things. Or putting a disclaimer in saying, sorry, this link's now dead. So
too bad.
Yeah, that's life. But I could be busy for, you know, if I live to about 90, then I've probably got a job for that time. So anyway, have
all
a
right,
room successor. Right, thanks, John. That's super.
Oh,
we haven't gone
you.
On too long. We haven't overdone this for you.
Just... Pushing 2 hours here, so it's probably time to call it quits. If anybody's still listening, thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much for your help, John.
Yep, you bet. Talk to you later.
See you later. Bye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.